The Koi Gig Pod on Off The Ball.
Like you said there with Grace Clinton, like if the club is serious about the women's team, you get players like that nailed down as soon as you can, because you can see the impact that she has on the team.
Subscribe to The Koi Gig Pod on the Off The Ball app now.
US Sport
on Off The Ball
with 888 Casino. 18 plus cgamblingcare.ie.
Okay, week 15 is almost in the books. Two Monday night games tonight, but we'll ignore them. Jer's not in today, but I am joined, as we always are, by our own Keane Fatty. Keane, how are you?
Good. Week 15, man. It feels like we started this season 3 weeks ago. How was this flown by so quickly? I'm not even saying that like to say the season has been particularly especially great this year. It just feels like it's been really, really quick for a reason I can't even think of.
That's the NFL all over. It always happens. They've added a week, but it still feels so short compared to our overall lives. And, you know, you try and make the most of it as you can, while you can. And then you kind of get a sort of a interesting on paper, but almost uneventful night like last night. And you kind of feel like it's a waste. But seismic news, perhaps. We'll see. We don't know yet, but never a good thing for an NFL fan to see Patrick Mahomes wincing, barely able to stand up, walking off the field. Bad news when you're in the fantasy semi-finals next week and you're relying on him and Alvin Kamara. I don't think anybody else cares about that, but damn it, I do. And but yeah, Mahomes, we don't know yet the extent of it. If I was to guess with my untrained eye, I'm thinking that's going to end up being a high ankle sprain. And he's going to be gone for 2-3 weeks. He's going to be back for the playoffs, but he's not going to be right for a month and a half, 2 months.
Yeah, they're saying week to week at the moment. Look, Mahomes is not an injury-prone quarterback. He's been a very durable quarterback throughout his career, but all of the injuries, at least all of the significant injuries he's had, have been ankle injuries. And we've seen this go in two directions. We've seen him win a Super Bowl with an ankle injury. We've seen him lose a Super Bowl with an ankle injury. I don't expect them to play again in the regular season. Like, their next game is Saturday, then they've got a game on Wednesday because of the Christmas schedule. I think there was talk already that he wouldn't play that Wednesday game anyway, just because it makes no sense to put your quarterback at risk at that point when you don't need to win games. So we're probably going to see Carson Wentz for the next 3 games, and it won't impact the Chiefs going into the playoffs. Obviously, we know Mahomes is like Johnny Sexton back in the day. He just turns up, he plays. He doesn't need 3 weeks of football to put him in position to be in form and ready to go. He'll just turn up and he'll be fine. But we've talked about this all throughout the season. In the playoffs, Patrick Mahomes turns up, starts running around, starts scrambling, starts making plays with his legs. That's the one thing he wasn't able to do when he had previous ankle injuries. And that's one thing you're terrified of with him, because when those bodies are falling on him within the pocket, that's how he got injured at the weekend. The body fell on his ankle. It wasn't a hip drop tackle, obviously. It was just in the crowd inside bodies. It happens sometimes. Your ankle gets trapped underneath. Now, if he's going to be in the pocket more during the playoffs, there's also more chance of that happening again and more him being injured again. One of the key plays in last year's Super Bowl against the 49ers was him scrambling. So these are the Chiefs are walking a fine line. They're walking an edge. Like, if you're watching this weekend's games and you saw Red Zone when the Chiefs won, Scott Hansen at the end was like, oh my God, the Chiefs won by 2 scores. That never happens. And we're like, we're talking about the best team in the league here, supposedly.
And we're playing against Jameis Winston and another guy. You know, like, it's not as if it was much of a... obviously the Browns' defense is vaunted and scary, and you don't want Myles Garrett running at you constantly through the game, but it was like the third time he got up wincing. And obviously it was the first time he was actually really hurt, but he's spending too much time on the ground. And it's funny, we've been talking about the Chiefs surviving this terrible offensive line, terrible probably offense all around outside of Patrick Mahomes at the moment. And, you know, they've been surviving it with wins, but if you lose, if you can't protect the guy who's getting you those wins, then you're not surviving. You know, so we'll have to see what happens here. But as you say, if he's not running around come playoff time, the Chiefs are in big trouble. You just wouldn't write them off at all. You just trust that between Andy Reid and Patrick Mahomes, they'll find a way. I know what you're saying about sit him down for the rest of the regular season, and I think on balance, I would agree. My concern is that the Bills are only one game behind them now and obviously have the tiebreak. Do you want to give up Arrowhead in a possible AFC Championship game? Maybe you don't think that far down. You know, they could probably do it the bye week as well. There's only one bye week these days for anyone who isn't keeping up. That's for the number one seed. Then also, it's like, if it does come down to the Bills, do you want to be in Arrowhead with all the noise, or do you want to be in the constant snowstorms of Buffalo, New York, and Josh Allen? I don't know.
I guess, who are they playing last three games? They're
playing the Steelers on Christmas anyway. And yeah. I don't know who they have next week, but there's a Saturday game against... I do have it here, hold on.
So, well, the problem anyway, if, once you pull that up, the problem is that the Bills
Texans,
have...
The Texans this week.
Yeah, away. So the Bills have the Patriots, Jets, Patriots. So the Bills are winning three games there, you assume. So even if you play Mahomes and he's hurt, and then you're just playing him and you're not like... It's not like you're going against the Raiders twice and you've got... the Broncos or someone in there where you expect to win with Mahomes starting. You're going against the Texans and the Steelers there where you're liable to still possibly lose one of those games anyway. And that's the two. The other part of this is the Texans have one of the best pass rushes in the league. The Steelers, although he went off injured at the weekend, so maybe he won't be there. Mm. They have TJ Watt who hits quarterbacks every single week. Do you really want to do that? Look, yeah, obviously playing an Arrowhead makes things completely different for you, but we also know Mahomes can go anywhere on the road and win. He's not going to be intimidated by playing in Buffalo. Like the other part of this as well is Isaiah Pacheco is back. So even with the all the stuff we were talking about earlier, the balance should in theory be there with the offense that wasn't there early in the year. It might even be something that actually galvanizes the team a little bit if he takes two or three games away and suddenly the wide receivers kind of realize, oh, we need to step up a bit here. We need to actually stop relying on Mahomes to bail us out all the time. We need to be this hard-nosed running football team with Pacheco and then make plays out of the backfield. Yeah, in a perfect world, you'd say, all right, Mahomes is a small injury, we'll play him through this and we'll get home field. But I think on the balance of things, you're kind of risking further injury and making it worse for something that you don't necessarily need, like you want, but you don't necessarily need it, I don't think.
Yeah, I think you're probably right on balance. I think it's probably worth pointing out both sides of it, but I think I ultimately do come down on your side there. And I think the kick up the whole argument is very interesting because you do keep winning Super Bowls. This guy does keep bailing you out. Maybe the levels are dropped a little bit around him, and maybe having suddenly looking up at your huddle and seeing Carson Wentz's face and an 11 instead of a 12, you kind of go, oh God, okay, I think I better play my part here. And maybe this actually brings them out. And I saw, like, even I thought, like, just a few plays that Wentz did play, suddenly I was seeing Xavier Worthy, for example, not just as this kind of like Trayvon Austin, hopefully get a trick play with him, but I think he caught two kind of first downs wide out in a very conventional wide receiver way, and you're like, yeah, that's what you want to see, you know. So maybe there's a bit of that in coming. We'll see with the Chiefs.
And you've got the other thing is you've got a guy like DeAndre Hopkins there who's been there for a little bit over a month now. And the thing about Hopkins is while he's a spectacular wide receiver and like a borderline Hall of Fame player, he's also always been a player who's got a mindset and a mentality of, I'm going to come in here and we're winning and I'm going to grab this and I'm going to grab it by the neck. And I have an awful feeling, well, not an awful feeling, but from the outside looking in, my perception of a mid-season trade like that, you can't immediately come into a locker room and be that kind of leadership mentor, that speaking up kind of guy. But when you are a veteran, a respected veteran like him, and you've been there for a month, suddenly you can become a little bit more of an identity. Because Wentz has a career behind him that was up and down, obviously. He's also famously not a leader in the locker room. Like, part of the problem in Philadelphia was a lot of his teammates didn't like him. So he's not going to come in the same way that previous backup used to come in and actually kind of elevate everyone around them and give them reasons to be confident. They're going to need guys around them. They're going to need Travis Kelce. They're going to need DeAndre Hopkins. They're going to need even Pacheco. Now, Pacheco's at the stage where he's been around long enough. These guys need to be the identity of this team for a couple of weeks and keep the needle ticking over. And hey, even without Mahomes, you've got Andy Reid, you've got all that talent, you've got, well, not all that talent anymore, but you've got enough talent there that they could still win those three games even without Mahomes. But yeah, I don't expect them to, but they might.
And they have a great defense. It doesn't show it every week, but you see it enough to know that they're going to be competitive in any game. The other, look, there was an amazing five games in the late window. It was good fun. I know you were probably deep diving individually on games, but for those of us watching Red Zone, we even had this like two marquee matchups, and we had like double boxes at times where it was like Brady versus Romo, and it was, you know, Brady's coming into his own a little bit, but Romo maybe still has the edge. But those two games, funny, if you look at the scores, you look at the box score, even especially in the Lions Bills, you see the score line, you know, both teams in the 40s, and you're thinking they were incredible, they lived up to it. Now, maybe in terms of analysis they did, but in terms of excitement, they kind of were a little bit of a letdown. It felt like the Bills had that game won from a long way out. They were exceptional in the first half, and it did feel like the Eagles kind of had the Steelers' number. And if you look at the Eagles and their trends recently, and we might just start with that just for the sake of the segue, we wondered, I suppose, if this winning streak was we're always talking about for real here on this podcast, but you know, you're wondering how, you know, can that stand up in the playoffs really? And the Steelers are a team that were just matching every test that they were coming up with, and they seemed a level below the Eagles last night.
Yeah, they played like it anyway, for sure. Like, actually, the first quarter, you mentioned there, like, the games themselves in terms of excitement were a bit of a struggle. But the first quarter and a half, I felt like all of them were great. I had Red Zone on, but I was also focusing on the Eagles-Steelers game specifically. And I remember saying at one point, I'm really happy that Red Zone are showing very, very little of the Cardinals-Patriots right now, because all these other games are amazing. It was like, just show us the touchdowns from that game and we'll focus on these games. But the
I agree.
as a Patriots fan. the Steelers... I think part of it was the Steelers were a little bit overwhelmed by just how talented the Eagles were. But for the Eagles, it's a very interesting thing, because the Eagles are famously a fan base that always thinks they're unbelievable, always backs their team, and always is like, to a degree of like rabid fan base that's admirable, but it's also a little bit out of touch with reality a lot of the time. And suddenly it kind of feels like they're a bit reserved and they're a bit quiet, because they're like, we've got this amazing record, but every single week we're looking at Jalen Hurts going, this doesn't look great. And AJ Brown last week threw gasoline on the fire by essentially saying Jalen Hurts needs to be better and get me the ball more. And in this game, you're kind of coming in going, right, it's the Steelers, it's TJ Watt, it's the defensive front, it's Saquon Barkley. What's going to happen here? You've got a quarterback who's struggling a bit with Hurts, so they're going to rely on Barkley, they're going to rely on Brown, rely on Devonta Smith as much as they can, take all the pressure off of Jalen Hurts. That's not what they did. They came out in the first drive and Jalen Hurts was in an empty set. No, Saquon wasn't even in the backfield. For the first three plays of the game, it was drop back, straight pass, drop back pass, drop back pass. Jalen Hurts connecting with receivers downfield. The first one was he hit his tight end down the seam on the right side. And then after that, he started to work AJ Brown in. And he started off really, really strong. He looked really great. And it caught the Steelers defense off guard, because they were clearly coming in expecting, right, we've got to stop Saquon here. And Saquon became an afterthought. He was like, he got his first touch four plays into the game. He was very much not being ridden in the first half. He was being given, he got the ball more in the second half, as far as I can remember, when they already had the lead and they were trying to close the game out. Mm. But with that said, Hurts made enough really good plays to get them out in front and then stay out in front. But the real story here was that the Eagles defense just shut the Steelers down completely. They had nowhere to go. They were beating themselves. Russell Wilson had, I think, six tipped balls tipped at the line of scrimmage by the end of the game. That was because Jalen Carter and the rest of that defensive line, Josh Sweat inside there, they were just timing out the plays. They were like, all right, we know you don't want to hold this ball in the pocket. We know it's coming out quickly. I remember this happening to Andy Dalton years and years ago late in the season. Teams figured out, okay, this is the timing of the play. This is the tempo of this play. This is when the ball is coming out. Now we're just adding six incompletions to your total without even having to rush you. So there was real, real struggles on the offensive side for the Steelers, and Mike Tomlin will be fuming about it all, and he'll be able to fix it against other teams. But the Eagles, just as a collective, there's just so much talent everywhere that they couldn't drag them into that arm wrestle matchup that they have every single week. And with that said, the Steelers gave it a good try in the first quarter, though. They had that stripped, they stripped Jalen Hurts on that scramble that set them up in great territory.
Two turnovers in two series for the Eagles, so it seemed like it was going to be one of those games. And obviously that defense can be amazing when they're on their best, at their best. But have we heard anything about TJ Watt yet? Nobody likes this. I saw him going over, it looked like his knee. And then it's weird, you almost were relieved when you saw him on the sideline getting treatment on his kind of foot ankle, you know, and that could be just as bad, but for some reason you kind of know when it's the knee, right, see you next year, bud. You know, there's a lot more variations, I suppose, in what could happen when it's the lower leg.
I think we did see him walk off kind of gingerly. I think it was one of the, we're evaluating from a distance here. It didn't look like something that was going to be season ending or terrifying like that. It did at start initially because he was on the ground writhing a little bit.
Yeah.
But then when he was walking off on the side, then it looked better. I think hopefully he'll be okay. He seems to be like his brother. He's one of those guys who can get injured, but then just keeps on playing somehow. It's like, didn't you not tear your quad last week? Oh yeah, but I'm still going to play this week anyway and get three sacks. What does it matter?
Yeah. Well, that's one possible Super Bowl. The other one, more quarterback analysis, I'm sure, Bills and Lions. Like, again, the scoreline, was it 48-42 in the end? You know, incredible stuff. But Josh Allen, I text you after the first quarter saying I think that might be the perfect quarter of football. Like, it was, he obviously, I think, rushed in for two touchdowns in that time, but he also, like, he was getting out, scrambling for plays, throwing across the field perfect. He just could not put a foot wrong. And we've been talking about him kind of all year, really. we're used to seeing miracle plays from Josh Allen. It's the type of quarterback he is, but he seems to be doing it without the mistakes a little bit more now this year.
Well, it's funny, like Lamar Jackson in the early window threw 5 touchdowns and everyone was like, oh, the MVP conversation's wide open again. And then Josh Allen just came back in the second window and was like, yeah, he just got probably the biggest signature win of the regular season. I'm pretty sure he's got the award locked up now. Mm. And you've got to give him so much credit because he came out and set a tone for his offense in that game. Yeah. Like they clearly had areas of the Lions defense they were targeting because they got Ty Johnson the ball twice on wheel routes out of the backfield and then over the middle. He ended up with over 100 yards receiving. That's your backup running back. He's at over 169 yards receiving, sorry, in the last 2 weeks, in the last two games. They've unearthed a gem there because he's just making plays over and over again. But Allen was, it was kind of the perfect encapsulation of who these teams are and why they're so different, because Jared Goff had those 5 touchdowns by the end of the game, but in the first half he was relying on all the structure around him to make plays for him and get the ball out, but it wasn't working because the Bills defensive line was so good and the play calling was so good, it kept them off balance. They did a really good job and Goff just couldn't adjust and anticipate, or couldn't adjust and make plays happen out of nothing. Whereas Allen, basically every passing play they had was him going, right, I'm going to hold the ball, right, look, no, I'm going to run around for a while and eventually I'm going to throw the ball. Like Keon Coleman had one catch in that game yesterday, and Keon Coleman's your number one wide receiver, or your number one pick, sorry, who you expected to elevate your offense a little bit. Mm-hmm. And his catch came on the most absurd throw from Allen, where he's got like 3 people around him on the sideline. He hits a tiny window over the top of the defense. But that all came about because Keon Coleman couldn't get open initially. Like Allen's not doing that because he wants to do that. He's hitting those throws because he's forced to do it. And I think the one thing that's not really been discussed this year is Josh Allen has always been a great runner, okay? But he's always been a scrambler, a chaotic runner, a guy who, when the play breaks down, he runs. But the Bills have done a much, much better job of giving him designed runs this year, which is part of what's pared that offense back down. So they're relying on their tight ends, they're relying on their running backs. James Cook had that big touchdown run as well that came with Allen being incorporated into the play. And that's going to change the identity of this team, because once Diggs left, they weren't trying to be this throw the ball everywhere offense anymore. And with that, I thought the way this was going to go was Allen would have so few receiver targets that he'd have to make way too many more plays and it would actually lead to more interceptions. And it's actually gone the complete opposite direction. You've got to give him massive credit. He's somehow taken away all the mistakes that he's had of this year. And the Bills have the best turnover ratio in the league right now because their defense is getting turnovers every single week and the offense no longer does that, whereas that was the big problem last year and the year before.
Yeah, and it's like, if that part does come out of his game, it's scary because he has everything else, like every physical asset. He has the brain for it as well. You do kind of think as well, is he adapting because he doesn't have as much trust? So he can't, maybe there was a case of throwing it up to double coverage in the past because I trust that Diggs is going to get this. And if he does an interception, that's the cost of doing business. We talked about that at the start of the year, that maybe his stats belied somebody who was kind of like playing this way as a strategy. You know, but maybe that's not true. Maybe that's a cop out. But we're certainly not seeing it at the moment. And he looks, I'll tell you, there was a, you kind of watch, like sometimes you think of different eras and you think of a different era where, you know, Brady and Mahomes are probably the, you know, the comparison from, you know, different eras. But you kind of think, who's Josh Allen then? And I was thinking last night, he's kind of in that Colts Peyton Manning mode at the moment for me, where he's never going to be out of a game. That offense is always going to have a chance, and if you're the opposition, you're always going to be scared of him. They might not ultimately get over the line every year, they might go out in the playoffs, but as long as he's at quarterback, that offense is going to just scare the living daylights out of defenses, defensive coordinators and fans of the opposition team.
Like, they've scored 90 points over the last 2 games and they lost one of those games. They somehow lost one of those games. I think the one caveat we have to put them with them right now, and it's not going to show up in the rest of the regular season, but it will become that question mark in the playoffs a little bit. They have gone against defenses in recent weeks that just cannot rush the passer at all. Like the Rams last week would have no pass rush on them. The Lions this week. So the Lions, this is a thing that probably most people don't realize. The Lions have the most players in the league on IR. Now, all of us, I think, would have probably guessed the San Francisco 49ers. And the reason for that is they've had loads of injuries on the offensive side. The Lions' offense is fully intact. They're not missing anyone as far as I know, not a single player. But they've got 12 players on IR. They lost three more last night who are all going to IR, two cornerbacks and another defensive lineman. They've lost their defensive line more than twice now. I think they've lost nine defensive linemen. So that's a defense there that is completely destroyed, completely decimated. 15 players on IR, that should shut you down. But because they're all on the defensive side, it means these shootout type of games are going to come. So against most teams, they'll still win because they can score so much that the other team can't keep up. But when you come against a Bills defense that has such discipline on the defensive side, you have Josh Allen on the offensive side, you have that running game and that offensive line playing as well as it was, and then you have Ed Oliver on the defensive line with guys like Rousseau coming with him and Von Miller, the pressure they were able to generate, all they needed to do to beat the Lions was win three or four drives in the first half, and then they won the whole game. So defensively, the Lions are in such a bad position. Like, the only comparable I have of a team winning a Super Bowl that has gone through all the injuries that they've gone through on one side of the ball was when Aaron Rodgers won his Super Bowl ring at the Packers 12, 13 years ago, whatever it is now. They lost about 22, 23 players that year, I think, but it was on both sides of the ball. And they had a quarterback who, in the playoffs, just lit himself on fire and was, like, unstoppable throwing the ball into windows that shouldn't have existed. And Jared Goff, we saw again, like, a quarterback who finishes the game with five touchdown passes and zero interceptions, and you're still coming away going, ooh, he didn't play very well. And that's kind of the way Goff is, because he just can't extend plays at all, and it's what we're going to see at this time of the year, and we're going to see it more and more in the playoffs. So it's going to give us some fascinating results once these games come about and actually get played.
Yeah. 14 years since the Packers won that game, would you believe? BJ Raji touchdown, wasn't it?
I think you heard me complaining this weekend about all the young people in the office that we have nowadays who are all enjoying their youth, and I'm here talking about BJ Raji, Rashad Mendenhall fumbling and Roethlisberger falling over it and all that. We're getting too old, Mick. This is a disgrace.
Without a doubt. At least this gives us a nice little frame of reference to talk about Super Bowls from 14 years ago. The Lions, it's funny because they're off, like, it is, I'm the exact same. You look at it and you go, God, Goff is this and that and the other, and it doesn't matter. That offense is just perfectly suited. It's a really well-balanced offense. Those two running backs are superb. St. Brown can do something where he makes an awful drop in one quarter, and then the next quarter he just bursts a regular, normal play open. Boom, 75-yard touchdown. They can kind of do it all, and they seem to be doing it all, but the defense is shattered, and it is hard to see how, and it could be the cursed franchise of them all, when they finally get this team together, everybody on one side of the ball gets injured. You can't make it through the playoffs. You're just going to get caught one of the weeks. Even if they had a game plan to beat the Eagles and everything kind of went perfectly, they could be caught by, like, the Rams the week before or something. You know what I mean? It's like, it's really hard to see how you could win a Super Bowl getting through the playoffs with that sort of injury list on the defense. It really is.
So we have to have our, just before we move off this game, we have to have our weekly discussion about Dan Campbell, I think.
Oh, I was waiting
where
for
do you
it,
stand
yeah.
on it?
Well, that's the exact same question I was going to ask. For those who didn't see, Dan Campbell, who we speak regularly of as being, it's in the DNA of this team, they take chances, they go for it on fourth down, etc. Tiki took it to a new extreme, really. They got themselves back into the game. They were they one score down?
Ten points down.
Okay, but there was 12 minutes left. So, you know, you're talking two possessions. Realistically, in that kind of game, you stop Allen once, you could take the lead. And they went for an onside kick, which in this day and age where you have to declare your onside kick and can't do a surprise one is ludicrous. Plus, they didn't cover it properly, and it was, you know, game over as soon as the Bills got that. So again, the scoreline doesn't really reflect that game. I don't know if many people are defending it.
No, I saw JJ Watt talking about it, and he's kind of, you expect him to give out, I suppose, because he's a defensive player, but, like, it's a 7% chance. Like, when the fact, what you said there is the most important thing. You've got to declare the onside kick now. That would have been a situation where you can 100% understand the surprise onside kick.
Yeah.
And it actually made me think, should the NFL go back to normal kickoffs in the fourth quarter? And that's what I was thinking. Like, in the fourth quarter, and maybe even playoff games, because you have to give, like, these onside kicks now are pointless. Kickoffs are largely pointless.
They haven't. Like, it hasn't made the kickoffs more exciting in general. So let's just go back to the way it was.
Yeah, I think they probably won't, just because of the safety aspect of it. But at least in because we have to, like, I'm not sure if people at home realize this, but the NFL has different rules in the fourth quarter and in the final 2 minutes of the quarter, of the fourth quarter, and in the final 2 minutes of the first half than they do the rest of the game. Like, there's a little small detail, such as, like, the referee moves from behind the quarterback into the middle of the defense in the fourth quarter because they need to speed up the play for getting the ball back reset when teams want to go into hurry-up offenses so they can get more time on the clock. So the NFL does not make rules based on what's fair and what makes equal and what gets the meritocracy results, the winner who deserves to be the winner. The NFL makes rules based on how do we make these games more exciting? How do we get more points? So the reason they moved the extra points back to 15 yards 10 years ago or whenever they did that was to have more missed kicks, which is what we're getting now, which gets a little bit more random stuff, which encourages teams to go for two more often. So the reason they changed the kickoffs was in the hope of it being more exciting, but also safer for players on the field. So I don't think it's worked. I think they will fairly be able to talk back into doing that, but I've buried the lead here because what Dan Campbell did to me is just absolutely insane. And when he was questioned on it, so after the press conferences, when these things work out, he goes into these press conferences, he's as positive as positive can be. He's like, "Ah, oh, I'm great, rah, 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 I'm really brilliant, anyone questioning me, yeah, yeah." And then he came in this time and he looked like a little boy. And it's hard to make Dan Campbell look like a little boy because he's 6'6", 350 pounds, whatever he is. And he was like, "Oh, I knew we were going to get it. I was certain we were going to get it. That's why I did it. Maybe I shouldn't have done it in the past." It's like, that's not the defense you can come with here. Yeah. The defense here has to be the thought process at the time, why you did this. If you came out and said, all of my defenders are injured,
yes,
Josh Allen is going up and down the field, we had to try something, fair enough. But that wasn't the argument. That wasn't the thought process. And that's what annoys me. I feel like he's riding a high of, I'm the most aggressive guy in the league. This has worked for me a bunch of times. Everyone talks about me when it goes well. Let's keep doing it that way. It's a bit like when defensive coordinators get blitz happy, because whenever a blitz works on the defense, or Chris Collinsworth or whoever is doing the commentary goes, look at that defensive coordinator, look how amazing he is. Instead of doing the smart thing of, all right, I'm going to play rush four, play coverage, I'm going to mix in some blitzes, they get mad and they do all this crazy stuff because it gives them highlights, that helps them get jobs, all that kind of stuff. So I think there's an emotional decision here from Dan Campbell that needs to be restrained a little bit and figured out to manage this team properly.
Yeah, and even if it did come from the desperation of not being able to stop them, that's only encouraged a bad decision. It hasn't, you know, it might explain it more, but it the desperation has encouraged a bad decision. It doesn't actually make it the right decision to go for an onside kick and basically give the, and make sure that Josh Allen is going to score. And again, it's funny because it is time that they started coming to terms with the fact that you don't go for an onside kick unless you have to, because Brady last week was actually really good on commentary in the Rams Bills game when the Bills took that time out on the quarterback sneak, and he was like, "No, you have to onside kick," and he's basically, "There's no chance of getting an onside kick, so why did you do this?" You know, so it was probably his best moment in commentary, really. But I think it's time. Oh, by the way, speaking of the NFL entire whole military industrial complex and not understanding anything, there was another dropped fourth down interception yesterday. I don't know if you saw it. I can't even remember what game it was, but the quarterback went up, big full dive, dropped it, started hitting the ground in anger. He would have lost 40 yards on the play. No commentator mentioned it, no coach mentioned it, no players. They don't have a collective understanding that you don't intercept on fourth down. It makes things worse.
That cornerback has like a 50 grand bonus for interception.
But that's okay. They shouldn't count on fourth down for a start. Interception should not count on fourth down for your bonuses, and that would take that out. But it will, because none of them seem to understand this. They never see it as a problem. Commentators never mention it. Watch out for it. I'm telling you, listener, I'm the only one on this bandwagon, but it's an important one. It's going to cost the team a game. I'm telling you.
Before we come across as wholly result-oriented, judging people based on results here, let's have a quick mention of the Saints-Washington game. The Commanders flew out to a lead. Jaden Daniels was outstanding, and then they started to struggle a little bit. And the Saints had an incredibly improbable comeback and had the opportunity to win the game with literally 0 seconds on the clock. They went for two when they were 1 point down. They rolled their backup quarterback, Spencer Rattler, who had come on to replace Jake Henry, and he missed the throw on the outside. But you're kind of sat there going, look, you have a backup quarterback in. Do you want to go to overtime and try and keep pace with Jaden Daniels, even if you have
contained
him in the
right
second
thing.
Half? No.
Yeah,
they did the whole
We were watching that live. I'm watching it with a Saints fan who went from like completely divested to massively invested just for the sake of a great comeback. And we've talked about that kind of thing all year. You know, when you have Patriots at the 70-yard field goal last week, suddenly you really want them to get it. But, you know, we were very, very into that game. And I was like, you have to go for it here. You have way less of it. You have all the momentum. You've got every play that you've looked for in the last like two drives. You need one more. That's way better chance than you have of going up and down the field during overtime and a, you know, 50-50 toss up on the coin toss and so on. So, I think I agree with that. The refs, by the way, there was a ball thrown into 2 yards, clock running. The refs stopped the clock for like 5 seconds. And then went, oh, shit.
I missed this.
Shit, and rolled it on. But stopped it for absolutely no reason. And then the Saints spiked the ball with 3 seconds to go. My sense when the ball was caught that they would have time to get the spike. But I don't know, they stopped the clock. It was absolutely insane. There was 9 seconds on the play.
This comes back to what we were talking about a while ago, but the rules being different. So the time rules are different within 2 minutes than they are outside of 2 minutes. And I'm not saying that they got this right.
No.
They definitely didn't get this right by the sounds of it. But what I do think happens is the refs have so many different things
to think
about.
They get confused.
Everyone thinks this stuff is so easy. But then you look at like 20-year NFL coaches who can't manage their timeouts and manage the clock. And you realize, oh yeah, he's trying to call plays right now. He's trying to get his substitution players in and out right now. He's trying to remember what his game plan is. And you're kind of going, I'm sat here and I've got a big clock in front of me. I don't have to think about any of that. No wonder. Yeah. I can manage the clock easily. Those guys are, there's just such a complicated sport and there's so much going on. I can kind of understand how those mistakes happen.
It's fair, and it didn't change the result in the game in the end. I suppose we should have just, I want to get to a couple more games, but Jaden Daniels, I thought he's definitely slightly dropping, but some of his play is still very, very impressive. Washington had a drive to try and kill the game that he didn't go for, but I think it was a coach's error for going for a really long field goal and giving the Saints good field position instead of punting down. I think they would have won the game, but Daniel's got a couple of first downs on that drive, which I think shows real maturity. It's something that doesn't happen a lot, I think, with rookie quarterbacks. He's still playing at a really high level, if not the level he was playing at in week 6, 7, 8, which is brilliant. Drake May had a little bit more of a kind of a struggle, I think, but Bo Nix definitely came back to earth a little bit yesterday.
To be fair, I haven't watched a lot of the... I know I've ruined your segue here, but I haven't watched a lot of that Drake May game yesterday, but everyone who I think has a brain talking football has turned around and said, Drake May was really good, and Drake May was actually the star of the Patriots. It was the Patriots as a team that were struggling, and May is actually like the ceiling with May right now. The more he plays, everyone's kind of going, oh, wow, this is actually really exciting.
I'm seeing him every week. He's fantastic. I really do mean it. Now, you have to wait and see when you're playing on a real team and so on, but he's got all the physical traits. He could do all the different little things, kind of what we were talking about, Josh Allen, obviously way below the standard in every way, but what we're saying in terms of his versatility and everything like that. Now, they're not giving him the ball enough. They're not putting it in his hand, but he didn't play well in the first three quarters. In the fourth quarter, funnily enough, he actually did play really, really well. He showed a touchdown pass that he threw to Douglas where he looked like he was rushing, completely sold the rush, and then tossed pass right on the line of scrimmage into the end zone. Mahomes-esque, you know what I mean? So he's superb, but I think, you know, it wasn't an easy game for him yesterday. You expect that with rookies. We've seen it lots with Kalen Williams. We've seen it with lots of others. But yeah, it's him on offense and it's Gonzalez on defense. And I think everybody else at the Patriots can get shipped out. Let's go free agent crazy next year.
You're not trying to keep those Kendrick Bourne deep shots going next year, no?
I'm okay. If I never see Booty or Bourne ever again, I'm okay with that. Don't worry about it. Let's not waste time talking about a 3-win team. We were going to talk about the Broncos. Quickly on the Packers, it was my first season-long bet came to fruition last night. The easiest one I'll ever have of the Packers plus 9.5 wins. They picked up their 10th with 3 weeks to spare. Was never really worried about this because I do think the Packers are a very good all-round team in a iffy conference, I think, as kind of shown by the Seahawks last night. You know, they're a team that's gone out, they've had some wins lately, you know, you beat Arizona twice and you think, oh, maybe the Seahawks are in it, but really there's just a lot of mediocre teams in the NFC, isn't there? Geno Smith went out injured. I know that's a massive caveat here.
No, I think they had the game won before that, to be honest with you. I'm surprised you weren't concerned about it earlier in the year, though, when Jordan Love was struggling a little bit with his own injuries and stuff like that.
I was very early in the year, yeah, yeah. But they were winning two games with Malik Willis helped, I have to say.
That's true. Yeah. But the thing that really stood out to me in this game was less the result. I kind of expected it to be a Packers win, but not as comfortably as it was. Like you mentioned, Geno Smith going out, and there was a late touchdown where Romeo Dobbs caught that incredible catch. I don't know how he made that play at the back of the end zone, pulled the ball off the blades of grass, essentially. But what really stood out to me in this game was just that Jordan Love... It was around this time last year, after Thanksgiving, when Jordan Love went from being this inconsistent guy every other week, you don't really know what you're getting, to, hey, suddenly I'm going to make every play here. I'm going to be consistent every single snap. That doesn't mean everyone around me is always going to make plays. There's going to be drops, there's going to be blown protections, there's going to be running plays that don't work when they should. But I'm this consistent pendulum thing where I feel inevitable. And I feel like that switch has been flipped again. I feel like we reached December and he's got this element in him that Mahomes also has where it's like, right, I'm going to play my best football when my team needs me to, or or when the games are their biggest. And the last couple of weeks now, like last week's game, I came away from it saying Christian Watson and Dubs were struggling. Watson in particular, he let them down against the, or sorry, 2 weeks ago against the Lions, he let them out in a big, big game. And those two were outstanding this week. And the difference between the Packers winning comfortably and the Packers losing a close game is the wide receivers, because Love is at this consistent ebb where it's like, right, I'm making quick decisions, I'm hitting tiny windows, I'm throwing the ball with incredible velocity, I can run and move around to avoid pass rush when the pass rush comes. Everything he's doing right now is at an extremely high level, and the ceiling that he has is, you know, every single year you talk about these teams where it's like, all right, these are the best teams in the league, these are the teams that you're scared of.
Yes.
Because the teams that you're scared of are the guys that are getting hot and that have that quarterback who, when he's fully healthy, can beat anyone. Like, we're not really going to talk about them this week because they had a fairly terrible performance and an awful result. But like, the Los Angeles Chargers fit into that group as well, because Justin Herbert threw his first interception in 12 games or something. Mm. And he's doing that while elevating a bunch of receivers who are fairly poor besides Ladd McConkey. And Love, to me, is in that same bracket. Like, previously, you would have put Joe Burrow in there prior to all the injuries. You would have, in the past, had a guy like Ben Roethlisberger and Eli Manning there. And I think this Packers team is the one in the NFC where it's like, besides the guys we expect, if we have a team that's the disruptor, the team that kind of comes from nowhere, yeah, although it's not really coming from nowhere, this is the team. This is the team you're looking at that could make a run.
I completely agree. I think so. If you're thinking like it's Lions, Eagles, the Vikings have to be taken seriously at this stage. It's the Packers next. And then we're not going to talk about them here, but you mentioned the Chargers. The Bucs, the kind of form they're in, if Mike Evans is going to do, like, you know, end of season playoff Mike Evans, they're just one of those teams that I can't see them making an NFC championship even, but I could see them scaring somebody or beating somebody along the way that we don't expect. So maybe, well, maybe it's not as bad a playoff situation in the NFC as we were talking a little bit.
The big benefit for the Bucs as well is they've put a massive priority on getting big defensive linemen, big athletic defensive linemen. A guy like Vita Vea is there, but they have these defensive ends who are just monsters too. So when the weather gets bad, even though they're like a warm weather team, they can just bully teams and they can actually shut teams down. And what they did at the weekend, obviously the weather wasn't bad in Los Angeles, but what they did at the weekend was beat the hell out of Justin Herbert and just hit him over and over and over again, to the point that Jim Harbaugh had to take him out once the game was out of hand, because he probably would have got hurt. The other one we should mention as well, and to be honest with you, now that we're talking with this, I'm realizing how good the NFC playoffs could potentially be. We haven't mentioned the Rams, and the Rams look like they're going to be in the playoffs at this stage.
Yeah.
And they're another team that fits that bill where if Matthew Stafford's hot, good luck. You might win, but you're going to struggle to win.
Yeah, so we're probably looking, it's looking clearer that it's going to be Detroit, Philadelphia, Rams, and Bucks as the four division winners, with the Vikings, Packers, and Commanders. You would think is almost certain.
You want to get Jaden Daniels in there, don't you?
That's pretty good. Like all those matchups would be fun in their own way. We're almost out of time, and we've two little news stories to talk about. But you wanted to talk about the Broncos a little bit. Bo Nix is my backup quarterback to Mahomes, by the way. So I wasn't enjoying seeing him throw. By the way, the other one is Geno Smith. So I kind of don't know what I'm going to do next week, to be honest, in a fantasy semi-final. But Bo Nix,
Carson Wentz is there. Pick Carson Wentz up.
Bo Nix threw three interceptions and kind of looked like, he didn't quite look like Will Levis, but he wasn't too far off it. But the Broncos still won that game comfortably enough. Like,
yeah, what a weird performance. Three interceptions, three touchdowns, and 130 passing yards. And you're like, what? How does that make sense?
Yeah.
But the Broncos as a team, so I actually wanted to get their full schedule, but I didn't actually manage to do it in time here. But they have 9 wins now. Like, they're very likely to be a 10-win team. Were any of us talking about the Broncos being a 10-win team before this season? I don't think so. But even while they've done that, I don't feel like anyone has brought them up during the season either. They've been kind of a secondary talking point throughout the year, because, like we've talked about previously, Bo Nix doesn't really excite you, but the team as a whole has been able to destroy bad teams, as far as I can tell. You're beating the Raiders, you're beating a team like the Colts, and the Colts game yesterday is particularly notable because they were losing that game comfortably. Anthony Richardson did not play well. Again, a lot of issues in Indianapolis as well with him, but he was bad yesterday. But they were losing that game. I think they scored 24 points in the last quarter and a half, and they were helped by the Colts special teams giving up a massive return.
Oh yeah, this is magic.
The trick play that failed, where they threw the ball back across the field and they turned into a pick six. And
it's like O'Driscoll against Munster all those years ago.
Which one was that?
In Crow Park. You don't remember it, no?
No.
He left Rodge for dead and the interception right down the middle.
Ah, yes.
It's hurtful to me as it is to you, Keane.
We had a clip on that recently, I believe, actually. But then the other one, the biggest story of this game, really, was the one you least expect, with Jonathan Taylor doing that thing that running backs seem to just be doing this year, where they're throwing the ball over the end zone, I don't understand. Like, look, I understand when the other running backs do it, and the young kick returners and wide receivers and whatever. Jonathan Taylor's been in this league for six plus years now, I think. He's the highest paid player on that team by some distance, as far as I know, unless the Forest Buckner is still getting that kind of money. He should not, like, that was the turning point in the game. If he scores that touchdown, they're gone. They're up to 20 points, and the Broncos had done literally nothing to that point. So, and then Anthony Richardson just was quite poor after that. So the Colts fell apart, and that, I think that's kind of the capturing of both of these teams' season. The Colts' self-sabotage is off the charts, and the Broncos won a game again where we're kind of going, are you guys actually good? Because you win a lot of games, but none of us ever say you're good. Maybe they deserve more respect. I don't know.
Yeah, I think so. Is a touchback a fair rule for that? I always feel like you've had this drive. Remember Ridder kept doing it for the Falcons, and he'd like be reaching for the end zone, and he'd drop it out and go out over the sideline, and suddenly the other team has the ball in the 20, and you're thinking, that's a bit harsh. Like, I mean, there's no other part of the field you're as harshly punished, you know?
I think it is, just for the simple reason that the reward of reaching for the... Look, let's talk about it outside of this scenario, because in this scenario, you deserve to be really shot. Never mind that, just lose the turnover. But when you're reaching for the pylon and you lose the ball out of your hand, I think the punishment has to be that severe because the reward is so high. You're trying to get that touchdown, those last couple of inches. And now there's a whole other conversation here where those last couple of inches used to be very difficult to get. Now, because of the whole pushing nonsense that I hate the teams are doing, this whole scrum, essentially, where Josh Allen can just put his head down and Jalen Hurts can put his head down and there's literally nothing the defense can do. And the refs, by the way, I don't know if we talked about this in the pod. How are we expecting the referees to actually measure these touchdowns on these sneaks?
I don't know.
There's a million bodies there. No one can see the ball.
Do you know what I mean?
How is this making sense?
No, I agree with you. Obviously, it's lost in the middle. But do you not think in general, though, like there was an incredible play yesterday. Was reached out, but it was on a long play, a stretch play, and his knee was down and you didn't see it live, and the hand goes up and they put it on the 1 yard line. You're like, how does the ref know that? Inch perfect. They're actually very good at that stuff. Like, for considering sometimes we're, and you know, if they get it wrong by a half a yard and it's the difference in the first down, we all go absolutely crazy and call them all idiots. Turns out, so most of these guys are actually very, very good at their job. But yeah, in the middle of a crush of 22 people, I'm not sure you can see who has the ball or where
the
they go.
The cameras can't even see it. And they've got an overhead look. But anyway, the
I think
main
they just see where the helmet ends up, don't they? It's just like,
yeah, but even then, the play could be over and just them moving a fella. By the time they actually run in from the sideline to actually see where he is, you don't know how accurate it is. But that's my whole thing, is that last yard, that should be difficult. That should not be this really easy thing that they can do. And that's why the punishment has to match the reward, I think.
Fair. Broncos have road games against the Chargers. That's Thursday night, I think, is it? 20th?
What's their previous notable wins? Who are their biggest wins? Yeah, of the year? As far as I can tell, they've beaten nobody.
No, they've won their last. They hammered the Falcons, actually, but they've actually won the last four games. They were very, very unlucky to lose to the Chiefs. That was the blocked field goal. Should have won that. Yeah. They were hammered to the Ravens, but yeah, they haven't beaten anyone as far as I can see. The Raiders.
That
twice.
Was a dangerous place to be.
Beat
for
the
a
Bucs,
rookie quarterback.
But the Bucs were bad early in the season. No, they haven't beaten anybody.
That's always a really dangerous place to be for a rookie quarterback, because his expectations, being on a 10-win team starting all the time for a second season, is going to be like, all right, now we're going to be challenging, aren't we? And you're kind of going, ooh, we just beat a bunch of like Raiders and stuff like that. We didn't actually have a high-quality 10-win year in
NFC,
last year.
NFC South and the Raiders twice. You know, like that is what it is. Right, we're almost out of time. We're going to talk about Randy Moss a little bit on the show this week, so we might talk to him again about it next week maybe. But Bill Belichick, we can't leave without talking about Bill going to a basketball team, as far as I can tell. I don't think I've ever seen North Carolina play football. I'm sure they are a Division I team of high standing, but I don't know. Maybe I just missed it. I don't really watch all that much college. But what do you make of it? It's unbelievable, really, isn't it? It's bizarre.
I just want to make sure I'm getting this right, because I'm pretty sure the man you're attaching all your hopes and
Drake
dreams
May
to
is North Carolina, isn't he? Yeah. Basketball guy for basketball family.
That's what it is. No,
they're always in the Final Four. That's what you know UNC from. It's Michael Jordan's college, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. No, they're 100%. They're a basketball school. They've been becoming more of a football school over recent times, like Mitch Trubisky. And the thing is, because they're Michael Jordan's next school and because the basketball team is so successful, they'll be able to pull money from a lot of places to give Bill Belichick that kind of contract, but also pay college players and bring in Michael Lombardi as a GM, which doesn't happen in college football, which it's a very fascinating thing. Like, Brady was asked about it on the commentary yesterday, and he was like, oh yeah, Bill is the greatest coach at this level ever, but he's also a little bit rough around the edges. He's not going to be going nice to, like, college football players. But I'm not really sure that's necessarily a thing college football players look for either. They're used to guys like Brian Kelly, like Nick Saban, who get in your face, shout and scream at you. Bill will probably do a little bit of that. This is going to be such an interesting dynamic because he's got to go and relate to these young kids, and he's got to go and go to their houses and basically beg them to come play for him, which, if anyone knows anything about Bill Belichick, that's never been a mantra of the way he works. He's, we'll take you if you're good enough, and we'll get rid of you for any reason, even if you're good enough. If your character doesn't align with what we want, you're gone. So how he builds that roster is going to be fascinating. But the one key detail for me, there's a couple of reports. One, apparently he went to the Jets and inquired about their head coaching position, and the Jets were not interested.
Apparently.
The other aspect, apparently, and the other aspect is his buyout clause, essentially, the specifics of it are a little bit different, but essentially his buyout clause goes from $25 million to $1 million if an NFL team arrives looking for him. So he's taken this job, and I don't feel like it's necessarily the job he wants. I think he took a job because he doesn't want to be an analyst all that much, although he's going to continue doing some of that.
Is it an addiction or what is it? And it can't be money, but maybe it's money. I don't know. But like, I feel like he could make a lot of money in TV. Why would you want to go in? Like, he's 72, 70, whatever it is. He's done this. He's the greatest NFL coach of all time. Is it a challenge? Maybe I just don't understand that kind of mentality, and it's to be applauded. But it feels to me like that's a big task. You look at Jim Harbaugh goes back to Michigan. It takes 5 years. You know, you have to build a program. You can't just take over somebody else's. And, you know, so it was successful in the end. But the other side of it is we've seen plenty of college coaches. The greatest college coach of all time, Nick Saban, well, probably maybe second best. Wasn't there a great, like, Alabama guy in the 60s? But anyway, like, Nick Saban, greatest modern college coach of all time, comes up, you know, had his stints in the NFL, like, other guys as well, plenty of them. The guy in Jacksonville, it was a disaster, for loads of hilarious reasons recently.
Urban Meyer,
yeah. You know, like, it doesn't always translate. The same could work the other way. If somebody, you know, these college guys kind of have their head tuned into that world a lot, you know, and suddenly you go back after, what, 40 years in the NFL?
Yeah.
And you know?
Bill is also an Army guy, I believe. He's either Army
Navy,
or Navy.
Yeah.
Some military, so it's probably just ingrained in him that, like, yeah. I imagine he's a guy who's waking up at 6 a.m. on his days off, making his bed after he gets out of it, like, having this very regimented breakfast every single day. I'd say he just lives for that, so football just fits naturally into his life. You mentioned a coach there from Alabama 60. I think I got very distracted because I think his name was Bear Bryant.
I just loved the idea of being
named Bear. Because I'm pretty sure, being that he was in Alabama, his actual name was Bear. That wasn't the nickname.
I had some discussions about first names during the coverage last night. I feel like we've overlooked the fact that Sauce Gardner's first name is Sauce. I just feel like that's just something that just happened. We all got to know him. He's a very, very good player.
It's a nickname.
Ahmad. What's Ahmad, his actual
Ahmad,
name?
Ahmad.
Ah, that's so boring. I thought he was christened. I thought he was, like, you know, the priest poured water on his head and said, I christened the Sauce.
I mean, we have guys named Sincere, we have guys named Amon Ra, we have guys named Equanimous. We've got enough, but no one will ever beat Dustin Byfuglien because, like, I know he was a hockey player, he wasn't an NFL player, but he's got the greatest name
What's
ever.
It?
And you're looking at, it's Dustin Byfuglien, and you're looking at me going, Dustin and is a first name, that's normal. Byfuglien is a second name, but it's the spelling of it. It's spectacular.
Like, okay.
Try and spell Byfuglien right now off the top of your head.
I don't think I'll bother. It doesn't beat the... There was a Jets guy called the Brickishaw Ferguson. Does he not win?
And there's a guy called D-Liner who played on the D-Line. He played for Alabama. But Dustin Byfuglien, I need to get this out there because it's an incredible name. Dustin Byfuglien, you spell his second name B-Y-F-U-L-G-I-E-N. Byfuglien. How the hell is that Byfuglien?
Probably it must be Welsh. Anyway, I'm getting overwhelming wrap-up signs here, which suggest that we've got off over time as usual, but also off the deep end as usual.
Yes.
So maybe we need Jer back. We don't have him next week, though, so it's me and you again for one more before Christmas next week. But We'll see you then. Enjoy double Monday Night Football tonight, Keane. I'm sure you're looking forward to Clash of the Titans in... Oh my God, I don't have it in front of me. There's some hilarious
Vikings game. Vikings-Bears is a good game.
No, it's the other one. Atlanta and... I don't know. Anyway, Vikings-Bears is a good game, is it? Bears are finished.
I don't get paid enough to watch Kirk Cousins anymore. I can't do it.
That's a fair point. You don't get paid at all for this, actually. But anyway... We'll see you next week.
I wish he was joking.
US Sport.
On Off the Ball.
With 888 Casino. 18 plus see gamblingcare.ie.